Welcome to Political Rewind, the start of a new week for us here in the Political Rewind studio. A lot of state news to talk about today, a whole lot going on from the weekend in the Trump White House that we'll get to during the show today, and some really interesting polling data about things like the Alabama Senate race, about what happens when people get an opportunity now to talk about how they think President Trump did on Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. So all sorts of things to talk about on today's show. Jim Galloway, of course, joins me. He is the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and is in the paper on Wednesdays and Sundays. Hi, Jim. Good weekend?
Yeah, had a great weekend.
There you go.
A little damp. Getting ready for Wednesday.
What Wednesday's column? Do you know what you're going to write about
yet? Okay, we had last week we had the Supreme Court take up gerrymandering. Yeah. We've got a really interesting case now going on in North Carolina that starts this week on North Carolina drawn lines. And at the center of both of those is the Duke University Department of Mathematics.
All right, we'll look forward to seeing that in the Wednesday paper. And of course, we've already started talking about the Supreme Court's case on gerrymandering, and we'll continue to follow it in the weeks and probably months ahead. Michael Thurman, what a pleasure to have you here, the CEO of DeKalb County. Since beginning of this year, you have had a long and illustrious career in Georgia political life, acting superintendent of the DeKalb County Schools. Went in there at a time when the schools really needed some significant management help, and you got great marks for the work that you did there. State representative from Athens, you've been all over
the place. Yeah, he did great work with DeKalb schools, so they said, let's give him something harder.
Thanks, Bill. Glad to be here. And you discovered me as a freshman backbenching legislator from Athens. You have to take credit for what I became, good, bad, or indifferent.
It is true that we first got to know each other. Betty, what year were you first in the legislature?
1987.
Wow. Okay. And Ed Lindsay, former Republican member of the state's House. It's great to have now at Denton's, the world's largest law firm. Are you in their political team with Eric Tannenblatt, or are you out there doing honest work?
Well, it's all honest work if you're a lawyer. No, Eric heads up our national team, and I head up the Georgia public policy team.
Okay.
Yeah, but on his business card, it says liberated politician.
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, recovering state legislator. Well, thank you for being here today, Ed. It's a real pleasure to have you here. You can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. I do not say that enough, and I want to. PoliticsGPB, and follow us if you pay attention to us on Twitter. All right, let's start. Jim, the state Republican Party is sponsoring a series of forums, debates, whatever you want to call them, around the state with their candidates for governor. And they already had two of them, the first two this weekend, Saturday morning in Milledgeville, down in Middle Georgia. And then last night, they all went over to Augusta and had a debate there. So they're really getting their candidates out there.
Very early. And actually, I mean, it's, and you see Democrats doing the same thing. We had the two Stacey's debate last week. So they're both kind of realizing that they need to get the ball rolling on this pretty quick.
Okay, let's talk about some of what came up, especially in the Milledgeville debate, but it came up over in Augusta as well. The AJC headlines on this story from Saturday morning is about religious freedom and the way they all stood on religious freedom legislation and on casino gambling. Let's start by listening to what Michael Williams. Oh, but we should point out, Jim, all of them support a religious liberty bill. They'd already signed a pledge saying they would.
Yeah, but you've got to read the fine print on it.
You want to explain that before we take
Well, the fine print for it varies from candidate to candidate. I think Michael Williams is probably more full-throated on what's been out there and voted upon. Casey Cagle is a little bit more judicious. He's saying that, yes, he's for religious freedom, but he doesn't want anything that would discriminate.
I'll tell you what, let's listen to first Michael Williams, because Michael Williams, former state senator.
Sitting.
Oh, he didn't give up his seat. No. I apologize. So he's still there. And he was asked where he stands on religious liberty. Of course, he says he supports a bill, much like the bills we've seen for the last four sessions, again this time. But he also used it as an opportunity to question Casey Cagle's credentials on religious liberty.
Our lieutenant governor, when it came up, put it in rules committee. He kind of buried it there in the rules committee. And then whenever he announced his candidacy, he talked about how RFRA should be a federal issue and not really taken up by the states. He since then changed his mind and signed on to the pledge. I am looking forward very much so to working with Lieutenant Governor and passing this piece of legislation out of the Senate this next upcoming session so that he can show everybody that he truly does support religious liberty.
Okay, something of a challenge to Casey Cagle, who responded like this.
Well, each of you are smart, educated individuals, and I think you can discern the truth and that facts are out there, and you don't have to necessarily take my word for it. The reality is that I have a very strong record for always standing up for our religious freedoms. My wife and I are born-again Christians, and we have raised our three boys in the same way. I have made a pledge that I will sign a mirror image of the federal RFRA, and I believe that that is the right thing to do.
Ed Lindsay, a couple things about his response. One, of course, is in many ways Casey Cagle brought on questions about where he stands on the bill, because he was for it until he was against it a year later. First time around, he was appealing to evangelicals in his constituency, or who he hoped would be his constituents as a gubernatorial candidate. And then he wanted last year to appeal to the business community, so he backed away a bit. So in some ways, he brought this on himself, yes?
He did in many ways, and it sort of reflects the difficulty that a lot of folks in the Republican Party have right now, trying to balance the concerns, the very legitimate concerns that the business community has against the concerns of folks who are supporting the religious liberty bill. What those of us in Metro Atlanta need to appreciate is how passionate this issue is among folks out beyond Metro Atlanta, and they are extremely passionate about it, and we need to give them some credit for that. But what those folks who are supporting the religious liberty bill need to take into account is how equally concerned those folks have in terms of the possible discriminatory effects it can have. And that's why I do like seeing some of the candidates bring up the fact that while we've got to protect religious liberty, we also have to deal with the possible negative impact from someone who may try to use it for discriminatory purposes.
I'm sorry, Jim, you talked about reading the fine print, and that's a perfect example. Casey Cagle says, mirroring the federal law, which is not necessarily what will be introduced in the Georgia Senate as a starting point next year, it may go a lot further than the federal law.
And we've seen, I mean, this is all about same-sex marriage, mm-hmm. and giving conservative Christians who want it some legal protections in their businesses, so that they need not do business with same-sex couples.
Well, one thing that I think could deal with that issue, Jim, and as we've discussed before. Georgia is one of the few states that doesn't have a civil rights bill. And in terms of dealing with that issue, if those folks who are advocates of a religious liberty bill would simply also support a civil rights bill in Georgia, we could sort of hopefully deal with this issue in one broad stroke.
The problem here is that this is a debate that's going to be begin again in January. Mm-hmm. And you've got a U.S. Justice Department that has just kind of laid down its emphasis that it's going to be falling seriously on the side of First Amendment and religious practitioners.
Well, and Mike, we know that the Georgia legislature has never been particularly interested in the hands of Republicans in passing any kind of state civil rights statute that would give protection to gays, lesbians. That's a non-starter for the Republicans downtown, isn't it?
And for the conservative Democrats who preceded them in power. But clearly we need to be sensitive to obviously religious freedom, but any state-sponsored act that discriminates against anyone because of their gender, sexual orientation must be rejected. I think it's to the credit of Governor Deal and his administration. They resisted efforts up until this point. But I would like to add one more thing. This is being played out with the potential of Amazon courted, hopefully, in other major corporations. And this could have a major, major impact on our ability to continue to create and spur economic growth and prosperity.
Well, I agree with Michael said in terms of the difficulty in getting it passed. What I'm hoping for, and the reason I raised it, is that it's time for us to start taking that separate issue of civil rights seriously, and the fact that we don't have a civil rights law in Georgia. As we have companies such as Amazon moving in, as we see the impact that it could have economically, and if we want to address those legitimate concerns that some of us, some of our friends in the religious community have, they also need to understand the religious concerns that those in the communities are worried about the discriminatory impact has. I'm simply saying, let's lay the groundwork. It may be a year, maybe two, maybe 3 years down the road before we do it, but let's mirror those two issues together.
The one attempt at civil rights legislation that I know has been in the Capitol a couple years running has been Wendell Willard's bill.
Actually, Rich Golick's bill.
Rich Golick's bill? Is that the one but it applies over to only to state government employees, or is that?
It applies to state government employees, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, has that gone anywhere? Has that had any traction?
I think it has some traction. Has it moved? No, not yet. But it has had some hearings, and I think it expects to have some more, and hopefully will be. Like I said, sometimes you got to deal with down the legislature, and Michael's been there, and you've watched it for years. Called relentless incrementalism. You keep pushing until you get something done.
Mike, where do you think the voters of Georgia stand on this issue? Republicans are going to carry this all the way through their primaries. They're going to talk up religious liberty. They're going to continue to talk it up, partly because they want to put Casey Cagle on the defensive. So the question is, what happens after the primaries? Are the voters of Georgia more inclined to support a pro-religious liberty candidate?
I think Leader Lindsey spoke volumes when he said that the base actually is very adamant and energized, the Republican conservative base. I'm not thinking so much with more moderate business-oriented Republicans as well as moderate and liberal Democrats. It may play well in the primary, not so much in November.
All right. Another issue that came up that I thought was pretty interesting was, and the reason I think it's already law, was campus carry, Jim. And one of the things that was fascinating about that, we're going to listen to Michael Williams in just a second on that. I'm sorry, to Hunter Hill on that. The question was, has the campus carry law gone far enough in protecting the rights of gun owners to carry guns on college campuses? Hunter Hill, when he answered that question, said, no, not really, because university officials can place too many restrictions. They have leeway within the law to really narrow where those guns can be carried, right?
Right, right. And although I don't think we've seen any evidence of that yet. The reports that we've been getting we haven't had any hardcore complaints from gun enthusiasts about being restricted.
Yeah, but we do know that. But there are people out there like a Hunter Hill who are really worried about this. Right? Oh,
but look, you will always have gun people who want to go a step further.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and I think in a little bit broader sense, I think we will look back, unfortunately, on the tragedy in Las Vegas. I think we've reached a tipping point, a recent inflection point on the expansion of unfettered rights to weapons in this country and in this state. Even some of the more conservatives with the bump stock, we're beginning to revisit this conversation. Their Second Amendment is sacred. However, it presents a unique opportunity for mentally deranged and other people to have tremendously damaging impacts on people's lives. And I just think we're beginning to rethink that. And years from now, we'll look back at this time and see that as an inflection point in this debate.
Well, I think as with all rights come certain responsibilities. And if you look closely at I think it was a 2008 decision that Justice Scalia wrote, he wrote about the fact that, yes, the Second Amendment applies to individuals as well as a well-organized militia in terms of giving folks rights to bear arms. But he also talked about there has to be certain safety concerns also involved, and there's a certain responsibility that must be carried by that gun owner, as well as the rights that they have to bear those arms. And I do think that you're going to see folks start to talk about responsibilities.
All right.
I've never been a proponent of folks who want to argue about gun restrictions. What I always want to tell people is, let's talk about the responsible use of guns.
All right. So one of the reasons I wanted to talk about Hunter Hill's comments on this, because at the end of his answer on campus carry, he established credentials that I think we should talk about just briefly. Let's listen to what he said.
Here's the bottom line. You know, I've fought 3 combat tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I felt the sting of needing to have protection to protect my life, and that is the Second Amendment, is for everybody in here to have the God-given right to protect themselves and their family, and it shall not be infringed, and I will be your greatest defender of that right.
Jim, I think it's fair to say that most people would consider Hunter Hill to be sort of back in the field a little bit. I mean, you've got certainly Casey Cagle is going to take up a lot of the oxygen in the room, but Brian Kemp, as Secretary of State, raised a lot of money. And yet, when he starts talking about his history, about his military service, and other things about his biography, it gives him a powerful platform that may surprise some people, yes?
Yeah, I mean, look, this guy was trained as an Army Ranger. I mean, he went to West Point, but he went to high school over at
Westminster.
At Westminster. And yet he went through Fort Benning's Army Ranger School. I think that will appeal to quite a few people. I think, just given we were talking about the gun debate, I kind of like the idea of having military personnel take up that issue, because generally speaking, they're very cognizant of what's necessary and what's not necessary on the street. And I haven't seen a cogent military, a veteran with recent experience, make an argument for automatic weapons on the streets of Atlanta.
All right.
Generally, it's just been the opposite.
All right, let's finish up this talk about the governor's debate. We're getting one more issue in, and let's listen just for a second to Secretary of State Brian Kemp talk about the issue of spreading the internet to rural Georgia.
What we need to do is get the private sector involved and have government there to get red tape and get that out of the way. I think involving a government agency like GTA is absolutely the wrong thing we need to do. We need to let the innovators innovate, get government out of the way, and as a governor, try to figure out how we incentivize or do public-private partnerships to make that happen.
Brian Kemp, talking about high-speed internet now, not just service.
Well, you know, Secretary Kemp brought up some great issues when it comes to the importance of broadband. If in the 21st century, if you want to have economic development, you better have broadband in your rural area. And one thing he didn't touch on is there are two groups that desperately need to be part of the team to expand it. One, and they both have a lot of right-of-ways that will help. One is GDOT, which right now has some restrictions in terms of its regulations.
Georgia Department of Transportation.
They're looking at rewriting their regulations to make it easier to expand broadband using their right-of-ways. And the other one is local governments, to get local governments to utilize their already existing right-of-ways to help put in the infrastructure for broadband. Those are two very critical issues.
Mike?
As a son of rural Georgia, obviously I support any efforts that will increase economic growth in rural Georgia. However, I am concerned that just relying on the private sector to do that will be enough. If you look at the fact that rural Georgia has suffered right now compared to 30 years ago, rural Georgia has a lot less influence in the Georgia General Assembly than what we had during my generation. I think the state must invest and play a much greater role if we are to spur and support economic growth in rural Georgia. Obviously, broadband is a key component of that, and it's an investment that we need to make. It's an old argument, Bill, that we remember from the 80s, the two Georgias that Governor Joe Frank Harris talked about. If we are to bridge that divide, there has to be a major investment on the public sector along with cooperation with private sector partners.
One of the interesting things, Bill, about this is the emphasis that Brian Kemp is giving to rural Georgia. He is really trying to capture that vote. I mean, you hear when Casey Cagle talks, much of what he's saying is aimed at Metro Atlanta and the greater Metro Atlanta area. But Brian Kemp is definitely appealing, trying to make his move below the net line.
All right. Well, we're going to watch the Republican campaign unfold, just as we have the Democratic campaign for governor, and a lot more to talk about. But it was great to have them all lay out some very basic positions that will be themes in this campaign to come. We got to get a break in here right now. We'll do that. And when we come back, let's talk about DACA. This is something that we thought President Trump had made a deal with the Democratic leadership on. Apparently, not so much. This is Political Rewind.
Wherever news is happening, GPB takes you there, from here in Georgia to the other side of the world. As Hurricane Irma moved into our state, we suspended our fall fund drive in order to provide you with the latest from GPB reporters across Georgia and GEMA to help keep you and your family safe. The campaign resumes October 12th, but don't wait. Your support now is a direct investment in the coverage you rely on day after day. Go to gpb.org and click donate. That's gpb.org, and thanks.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Georgia Public Broadcasting. We're an 18-station radio network of GPB. I'm Ellen Reinhart. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, ranked among the top universities in the nation in commitment to undergraduate teaching.
In the studio with us for Political Rewind, Jim Galloway of the AJC, Ed Lindsay, a former Republican leader down at the Georgia State Legislature. I should have said that when we introduced you to begin with. Ed,
this guy was the whip.
He was. We should also point out, I did not know this until they walked into the studio, that Ed Lindsay, he's a Republican. Mike Thurman, the CEO of DeKalb County, is also here, is a Democrat. But you guys told us that, Ed, you're a lobbyist for DeKalb and for Mike Thurman down at the Capitol.
I am. I'm a great supporter of Mr. Thurman.
Okay.
He does an outstanding job. I don't know whether you noticed, Bill, except the Republicans run everything in the Georgia.
I think I got that. Mike, let me start with you on this. The president, largely at the urging, apparently, from what we're told of Stephen Miller, who came into the White House as along with Jeff Sessions. He was Sessions' main man on, I don't know if he was chief of staff, but he was certainly his top advisor when Sessions was in the Senate. And Stephen Miller has laid out, and the president seems to have gone along with, some conditions we didn't expect that might be part of a deal to extend the protections for DACA young people in this country. So the plan that apparently is going over from the White House to the Hill includes this: definitely construction of a southern border wall, an amendment of the law that allows removal. They're going to now allow for what they call unaccompanied alien children to be removed quickly. That means if you're a 12-year-old who's come up, say, from Guatemala, and has made that hazardous journey all the way up here, there used to be a longer process that needed to take place before you could be sent back. This measure would, in fact, speed that process up so those kids could be sent back fairly quickly. It would block grants for sanctuary cities. They want to hire 10,000 more immigration officers, and they would end what they call extended family chain migration. If you're in the country, you can't have your grandmother, your grandfather, your aunt, your uncle. It's just immediate family. This is not what Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer thought they had gotten the president to agree to when they said they had a deal.
Well, it depends. I think the president undercut the Republican leaders in the House and the Senate when he, quote, cut a deal with Chuck and Nancy. And this is retracing those steps to kind of reset the table so that the legislative leaders can leverage whatever they can from this process. I think it's basically a negotiating tactic now, a little bit late in the game, but I think it will create an opportunity for them to have a discussion.
So before we open this up for everybody, the AJC over the weekend reported that they have a number of about 16,500 DACA recipients or people protected by DACA living in Atlanta, Sandy Springs, that general area. You, as superintendent of schools, saw DACA at work in your schools in DeKalb County.
I think that number doesn't take into full account. Not generally understood is that local public school systems cannot inquire into the immigration status of its students. So we are educating hundreds, if not tens of thousands of young people, number one, who may have been born to illegal immigrants in this country, which makes them Americans, as well as those who came accompanied by parents. That's one of the major conflicts in federal law. You cannot inquire, you must educate, and now we are going to now create an inquiry so those young people that we've invested tens of millions of dollars in educating, there is this idea that we will now deport them out of this country. I think it's unconscionable, and obviously everyone on the left and the right will do what is necessary to make sure that that does not occur.
Well, I think what you're seeing, as you mentioned a moment ago, is sort of the opening salvos back and forth. You know, this morning driving in to the office, I was flipping the dial back and forth between various cable channels, and I heard, you know, in reaction to what the president was putting out, I had some folks on the left suddenly arguing for open borders to go back and forth. At the end of the day, the overwhelming majority of Americans want to make sure that these dreamers, whose only, quote, crime, unquote, was to follow their parents across the border, will be protected. What goes along with it in terms of enforcement issues and that sort of thing, we'll see. I'm sure there's got to be some issues dealing with enforcement that need to be taken care of. But I don't want to scare folks who are dreamers. I do believe that there is a broad consensus within both parties at the end of the day, before this deadline runs out, to protect them.
Jim, this is right back to the president's base, though.
It goes right to his base. But I would think that some of those things are, like Michael says, are there to be negotiated away. Number one, I think we did get a statement out of the White House during the whole Chuck and Nancy episode that the wall was not going to be a part of this bargain, and I think that's a line that Democrats are not willing to cross. I think they would stand firm on that. Wait. But the other part of that, and the other limits on immigration, I think you might find some Democratic buy-in on, especially as it kind of follows along the David Perdue Tom Cotton bill. But the other part, you're already seeing some resistance in the Senate. You had John Cornyn of Texas say this move to tack a whole lot of stuff onto a DACA bill is a mistake, that the Senate would prefer a clean DACA bill, that they just vote up and take this issue off the table.
Well, but I think it's interesting, Mike, that to some extent, during the health care debate, the president showed his supposedly Republican colleagues that they couldn't necessarily always trust him when he, for instance, called the House health care bill cruel, mean-spirited. So now he's said, well, I'll work across the aisle with Democrats, and if I can make a deal with Chuck and Nancy, I'll do it. And now they have reason to wonder if they can trust him, too.
Well, and the most recent attack against Senator Corker from Tennessee, I think, was ill-advised. When you think about, you have a two-vote majority, and you will need every Republican to get anything through the Senate, whether it's DACA or health care or anything else, and the attack on Senator Corker raises questions about how much this administration may be able to maneuver through the legislative process. One last thing, when you talk about immigration, and you mentioned my services superintendent at DeKalb, I was shocked. Jim and I, when we talk about demographic trends, we're talking about in terms of when the state might trend purple or blue. And that might be 5 years, 10 years. If you are working in a public school system in the state of Georgia, the transformation is already
occurred. You're there, right. Yeah.
It's over. It's already happened. And I don't think that many of our political leaders fully understand dramatic transformation that's taking place in DeKalb and all across Metro Atlanta and all across the state of Georgia.
That is something that Governor Deal has spoken of, actually, on more than one occasion. The fact that those demographic trends that we expect to see statewide are already existing in the schools, and that the state and the local school boards need to be coming up with policies to address it so that those students can be educated in our system.
All right. So, Mike, you really gave us a lead into our, the next topic of conversation. Jim, starting Sunday morning, the president woke up and decided it was a good day to attack the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, Republican Bob Corker, who's already announced he's not going to run for another term. And the president unleashed a volley of attacks on him, including just a few. Senator Bob Corker begged me to endorse him for re-election in Tennessee. I said no, and he dropped out, said he could not win without my endorsement. Also wanted to be Secretary of State. I said no, thanks. He's also largely responsible for the horrendous Iran deal. Hence, I would fully expect Corker to be a negative voice and stand in the way of our great agenda. Didn't have the guts to run. By the way, Corker opposed the Iran deal. He did not work to pass it. The president has that wrong.
And one could argue that if one is chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, one doesn't need to be Secretary of State.
And of course, then Corker gave this remarkable interview to the New York Times in which he said the president was treating his office like a reality show and that his threats toward other countries, obviously he means mostly North Korea, could set the nation on the path to World War III.
But before he did that, he replied in the president's own medium, and he said basically that the White House had become an adult daycare center and that somebody clearly missed his shift. The reason I point that out is, okay, we know the president's style, we know how he writes. That was a cold, calculated, well-composed 140 characters from Bob Corker. That wasn't an off-the-cuff.
He had it ready to go.
That was, I don't know if he had it ready to go, but it was completely premeditated.
Well, he also said in a tweet, Ed, I don't know why the president feels a need to lie about everything. He certainly denies that he begged the president for his endorsement, and there's no reason to think he probably did do that.
Well, the larger issue is Senator Corker, who has been an outstanding public servant. He was an outstanding public servant. I believe he was the mayor of Chattanooga.
Mayor of Chattanooga, right.
And was very highly regarded there. He's been a very highly regarded U.S. senator. He has worked within his own caucus and with the Democratic caucus to try to advance good, solid public policy. And it just goes to show you, quite frankly, what's happening to him and with some of the others up there when they do try to seek common ground. And I'm starting to believe that common ground is a misnomer, that you ought to call it no man's land. Because whenever one side or the other seeks to come in and work with the other side, they suddenly find themselves getting shot at by both sides. And that's a dangerous place for us to be as a society when our public officials cannot try to build broad coalitions to get something advanced. And I'm sort of disappointed in that. I'm disappointed he's not running again. I think that he's been a good public servant. I don't agree with him on everything he's done. But then again, you know, my wife doesn't agree with everything I've ever done.
Mike, you pointed it out already, but it's worth reemphasizing. The president of the United States needs every Republican vote he can get. He's got a big tax plan. Corker is famously a fiscal conservative. And if, in fact, the president's plan is going to increase the debt by trillions of dollars over 10 years, it would take a lot of persuading to get Corker on board with that in any case. But it's certainly not going to be helped by the president's attacks on him.
Absolutely not. And to Ed's point, my wife is from Chattanooga, so I followed his career for several years, beginning as mayor. And I don't agree with all of his positions, but I've always admired his candor and his leadership ability. And I just think it's mind-boggling that our president would attack this man who has such credibility, I think. But it goes to Ed's point about common ground. Right before I came, I ran into Congressman Buddy Darden and Judge Norman Underwood.
Known as Uncle Buddy on this show.
Yeah, down at the Silver Skillet. I had to stop. And one of the things we talked about was the lack of the ability to build coalitions and consensus in politics. And not just with Republicans and Democrats. Now it's among Republicans. And there's a growing, so we have to think about what we can do as a nation to build some consensus on issues that benefit all citizens so that we can progress this nation and our state. And it's becoming more and more difficult, not just in Washington, but also here in Georgia.
Well, you know, Will Rogers was famous to have quoted one time that he's not part of any organized party. He was a Democrat.
Yeah. Jim, you want to get a word in
and,
before we
And
break?
I'm beginning to think maybe my own party sometimes are down that path.
No, all I was going to say is that just we need to remember that this is a continued demonstration of the chasm between the White House and everyone else when it comes to U.S. foreign policy, and that this was an outgrowth of Trump's fight with his own Secretary of State over Korea.
Right.
All right, we're going to take a break in just a second, get our second and final break out of the way. Before we do, you know, we talked a lot about guns on the show on Wednesday, and Saturday Night Live talked a lot about guns on their show Saturday night.
This shouldn't be a partisan issue. The guy had 47 guns. No one should own 47 of anything. If you own 47 cats, you are not a responsible pet owner. You're a crazy cat lady. And unlike with guns, the government will actually come and take your cats away because everyone agrees that's insane. Also, this guy bought 33 of his guns in the past year, and that didn't set off any kind of alert. If I buy $100 worth of Chick-fil-A, I get a text message from my bank that says, "Did you just purchase $100 worth of Chick-fil-A? Please, Colin, tell us this is fraud."
Colin Jost on Weekend Update. When we come back, we're going to talk for just a minute about a gun law that our friend and guest today, panelist today, Ed Lindsay, wishes he hadn't voted for. This is Political Rewind.
Every day, NPR's All Things Considered includes news that keeps you ahead of the curve.
There has never been so much data about so many of us so easily available to law enforcement.
Plus, the unexpected.
The biggest concern is still what's in the water. Who wants to eat a cow that drinks water laced with benzene?
All Things Considered from NPR News. Listen later today.
You can hear All Things Considered this afternoon from 4 till 7 here on 88.5 GPB Atlanta.
Jim Galloway, you wrote a column the other day about a state law. We should also get Mike Thurmond in on this one. In many jurisdictions around the country, when law enforcement confiscates guns, they melt them down. What happens in Georgia?
Well, I don't know what happens in Georgia. I know what
What's
the law
supposed
says.
To happen
I
in
know
Georgia.
What the law says. There was a 2012 law passed. This was Don Balfour, the rules chairman, was the chief sponsor, and it mandates that all guns confiscated as a result of criminal investigations that are not returned to their proper owners should be auctioned off. They cannot the local governments are prohibited from destroying them. They have to be auctioned off. I think some law local governments are waiting to be forced to obey that law.
Ed Lindsay, you have said that was a statute that you a bill that you voted for, and you've come to wish you hadn't, right?
Well, yeah. Well, let's just put it this way: it's one of these, I hate to say it, throwaway bills that come on day 40. You look at it and you go, well, you know, if local governments want to raise money rather than boil a gun down, so be it, and maybe that's probably a better idea. But 2020 hindsight, yeah, I mean, that's a bill that we probably didn't need. We probably should have allowed local governments to decide for themselves whether or not they want to auction them off or melt them down. And, you know, I'll add that to the list of bills that maybe I should have given a little bit more thought.
Mike, should you, as CEO of the county, be the one who decides whether law enforcement disposes of guns legally or by some other means, or is that in the hands of the sheriff and the police department?
Well, I have a text in to my police chief, Chief Conroy.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for a response. I do not know the answer. I know we have over a million items in our evidence storage area and suspect a large percentage of that are confiscated guns. I'll have to get back to you, Bill.
But I mean, my point in what I wrote was that It's a law that puts a value on the life of the gun, not the right to bear arms, but it puts a value on the life of the gun. Yeah. The gun, the state mandates that local governments find this gun a new owner.
Yeah, right. Yeah. The guy who used the gun to shoot someone in the leg may go to jail. If he's convicted of the crime, but the gun lives on.
The gun lives on and gets a new owner.
I would like to point out it had broad bipartisan support.
Absolutely. Okay. Yes. Right. I'm sorry. It did. It did.
But one thing I've struggled with, the most sovereign aspect of being a CEO or a mayor or a county commission chair, is that you have ultimate responsibility for law and order and protecting the health, safety, and welfare of the people who elected you. But, and the issue around the Second Amendment and gun rights, and let me tell you the flashpoint in this, where you see a dichotomy in philosophy for those who hold the Second Amendment sacred and those who want more restrictions on gun ownership. In urban DeKalb, urban America, particularly here in Metro Atlanta, we no longer count the dead of young minority men who've been murdered in our county, in this region, and in this state. So many have died, been maimed and wounded, that we, if you notice, when we report on the evening news of another murder, whether it's gang related or whatever, media no longer counts the dead.
Yeah.
Well, that's how devastating it is. And when you hear some on the left talking about restrictions, it's not for restrictions for people to be able to hunt and spend time with family and friends and be law abiding. But we in urban areas have witnessed all of the destruction and the despair that these violent acts are causing. And when you see gangbangers possessing automatic weapons that are typically used in warfare, fighting drug wars, then we are crying out, the neighborhoods are crying out for someone to intervene and to protect the innocent.
Well, it gets back to what we talked about a little while ago, that every constitutional amendment that deals with certain freedoms also bear with them responsibilities for those who exercise it, as well as a safety concern. First Amendment, freedom of speech, you also have the safety concern of you can't go into a crowded theater and yell fire. You know, Second Amendment, you know, right to bear arms, that comes with it the responsibility to bear those arms responsibly. And you go all the way down through the other amendments too. And we need to be looking at laws that promote responsible gun ownership.
Okay, I want to move on. Let's touch on this relatively quickly if we can, Jim. Vice President Pence decided to take in an Indianapolis Colts game yesterday. Maybe he didn't really decide to take it in. Maybe he decided to go there so that he could leave. When the San Francisco 49ers came out, they famously kneel. They're the team that started it with Colin Kaepernick. The vice president got up and left. Trump tweeted that it was done in his order, and now it appears that this was planned all along.
It was orchestrated. I mean, I you know, it was as long as everybody understands that it was orchestrated. I mean, the 49ers knew what they were going to do. Pence obviously knew what he was going to do. The reporters were kept on the bus. Everyone knew that the appearance was going to be forestalled. The White House, the long formal statement out of the White House came 30 minutes after.
Less.
Pence,
I think it was. I think it was released at 1:08. The anthem at 1:00.
So this is all fine. Just everybody acknowledge it's theater.
All right.
I didn't see the reporting. How many diehard Colts fans walked out with him?
But it does raise an interesting...
I mean, really, how many fans left?
It does raise an interesting question. This is not a First Amendment issue. This is a business issue. There's no question that the players have a right to stand or kneel. No question, however, that the fans have a right to either watch or not watch. The more interesting question is, how does a business, and that's what the NFL is, how does a business deal with an issue in which their high-paid employees are undertaking activities that their customers, that many customers, find distasteful? And that's going to be, to me, the more interesting question. And I look forward to talking to my friends who teach in the business schools and the marketing schools on how they phrase the questions next semester.
Well, you may have just seen the answer kind of come out of KSU, Kennesaw State University, where you had
cheerleaders.
Saturday week, cheerleaders take a knee. Yesterday, they were kept in the locker rooms until after the anthem.
Yeah. And there's to Ed's point, I think good conservative business principles said let the market determine that.
Yeah.
I don't think politicians should insert themselves. The market will determine whether or not
All right.
Well, owners.
I got to get interrupt. We got to move on because there's one more topic we got to get to. By the way, Sam Olens, president of KSU, thought he was getting out of politics when he left the attorney general's office to take that job. No, Sam, you did not. He'll be dealing with this for a while. Jim Galloway, we teased at the beginning of the show. We talked at least briefly, and we'll have plenty of time to do this as the election for mayor of Atlanta comes up. But the second guilty plea, this time the chief purchasing officer of the city of Atlanta, really heats up this race in terms of people who are currently on city council, or a Peter Amon, who in the first term of Mayor Kasim Reed was his COO. It puts a shadow over this entire race for people.
It puts a shadow on the entire race. And Ed, you have more dealings with lawyers who are also prosecutors than I do. I don't think that shadow is going to leave because I don't think you're going to see a federal prosecutor issue climb up that ladder before
that's
November 7th.
Right. There's no Jim Comey. We're going to try to resolve this before the election.
And as a matter of fact, it's kind of a principle of the federal prosecutors that they try not to step on to the issue of elections. Nevertheless, it leaves a lot of questions for voters. You know, you have $1.6 million in bribes. Mm-hmm. Two people have pled guilty to that. Now, last time I remember, if you give $1.6 million in bribes, that means somebody received $1.6 million in bribes. And we don't have that entire question answered. And so that leaves a lot of questions for voters as to where exactly that money came, where exactly the money went.
Mike?
Yes, obviously a shadow over the campaign. You know, I have a pain and I empathize, though, with the honest men and women who are currently employed in Atlanta city government, because it's a shadow over the entire government, and hopefully we won't paint a broad brush on honest men and women who come to work every day.
Well, that's probably right. Nevertheless, if you are one of those outsider, if you're Kathy Woolard running for mayor right now, you've got ammunition now to use, even though there's no proof of any misconduct by any of the candidates for mayor, right, Jim?
Right, or the incumbent.
Well, and I'm not speaking so much of the people who are vying for the mayorship. I'm talking about the men and women who actually do the work.
Right.
And they have not been implicated or indicted or arrested, and we should keep that in mind. It's not indicative of every man and woman who actually works for the city of Atlanta or any other government.
All right. Story is going to be, I think you're right, Jim, is going to be with us all the way through the end.
And through a runoff, too.
Through the runoff.
Through December 5th runoff.
Hey, Jim, one other thing that I didn't get to. I was going to do it earlier in the show, and I didn't. We have a new candidate. We do have now a candidate running in the 6th Congressional District on the Democratic side. And what's interesting about it, so we talked the other day about the question, John Ossoff sort of teased people that he may very well want to get into this race again. He says if he does, apparently he's going to be much more harsh in terms of dealing with Donald Trump. But in the meantime, he's not said anything yet, but we have a guy out of my business who decided he wants to jump into the race. A former television reporter anchor over at CBS 46, Bobby Kappel, has declared he's running for the 6th district seat. And goodness knows, what it reminds me of, Jim, is when Hal Suits.
Yes, yes.
The anchorman for Channel 11, Channel 2 in those days.
1966.
1970.
1970.
Oh, you remember that?
He had a wooden leg. He was a World War II vet and lost a leg and was well-spoken. But unfortunately, he was also Republican.
Yeah. The story that makes the rounds at Channel 2, and I have yet to confirm it, but I'd love to, is that Suit announced his candidacy sitting at the anchor desk on the air without telling management he was going to do it, and they immediately had to yank him off during a commercial break at it.
Well, I don't know who this fine young man is, but I suggest that he keep his resume handled because I'm willing to bet on Karen for 2018.
Well, you know, to give him credit, he says, I can't sit behind the anchor desk to report on, this is a quote, on this mess. I've got to do what I can to try to fix
it. And I think what that is, that's a not a bad bet that John Ossoff is going to skip this race this time.
Wow. Mike, what do you think? You're a Democrat. I know that over at DeKalb you try to maintain a nonpartisan bent, but you're part of that 6th district, part of your county.
Well, and to Mr. Ossoff, you know, I've run and lost races.
No.
Yes, and I like to remember that. The first two for state rep, I've lost for the U.S. Congress. I ran a race for the U.S. Senate, didn't come close. It's tough to come back. You know, when you get that public no and complete rejection, it's like, I tell people, it's like asking for a date, and then they report it on the 6 o'clock news. She said no.
And let us be clear. Mr. Lindsay has experienced that rejection.
I have enjoyed the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat.
It takes a lot to will yourself and wheel yourself back out to ask the public or ask for a date again from the general public. Cool. It is tough.
What I tell people is, I don't know if I'm cured or if I'm in remission, but my wife likes my present job.
Yeah. But, you know, hope springs eternal. The only race that really counts is the last one. Yeah.
All right. We are completely out of time for today's show. Ed Lindsay, it's really great to have you in here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Coming in and being with us. And Mike Thurman, you know, one of the things we did not talk about today, and so we should invite you back to do it, is the kind of issues that you're dealing with as CEO of DeKalb, infrastructure, transportation, other issues that are faced by many municipalities and counties in certainly in the metro area and to some extent around the state. Will you come back and talk with us about that at some point down the line?
Absolutely, especially our SPLOS. We were preparing to vote in November on the first ever SPLOS in DeKalb. We have over 400 miles of roads that are in disrepair, bridges and streets, so DeKalb voters will have a unique opportunity to address a critical issue in DeKalb, and I'll be happy to come back and discuss it.
Jim Galloway, always a pleasure to have you. I'll see you back here on Friday for the last show of the week.
Yeah, the late-breaking news show.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We'll speculate during that show on who is going to be let go from the Trump administration by 6 o'clock that evening. That's it for us. Olivia Rheingold, Jenny Ammon, Tyler Morris, back from the Hawaiian Islands. It's good to have you. We're rested and back running the board, our engineer, and Tom Faust. Thank you all for your work on the show today. I'm Bill Nigut. We will be back on Wednesday at 2 o'clock with another Political Rewind among our panelists. Patricia Murphy, columnist for The Daily Beast, will be back with us. Who knows what we'll talk about? Sam Zamarripa will be here, former Democratic state senator. We'll talk about some of the issues that deal with with DACA again, probably, and immigration policy with Sam. So come on back on Wednesday at 2. I'm Bill Nigut. Thanks for being with us today. See you then.